So our first session of the afternoon is titled Epidemiology Across the Lifespan. The session will be chaired by Caroline Quash, who is an associate professor in our department, as well as in the Department of Pediatrics, and an infectious disease specialist, if I may add, who has been pretty busy these past few months. So we're very happy to have her chair the session. So, Caroline, the floor is yours, and the mic as well.
So thank you, Gilles, and good afternoon, everybody. So I'm a pediatrician, I guess, who is getting older, as my immune system showed it to me last winter when it was challenged with influenza A and B after being vaccinated. And so it is my great pleasure to moderate this session this afternoon of Epidemiology Across a Lifespan. The first speaker is Dr. Michael Kramer, who is a James McGill professor in the department here, who is also the director of the Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation at the Research Institute of the McGill University Health Center, and who is a prenatal epidemiologist who has published more papers than I can actually count. And so it's my pleasure to introduce you, Dr. Kramer, who will be talking about McGill's contribution to perinatal and pediatric epidemiology.
Thank you very much, Caroline. So I didn't really know how to kind of discuss this topic, and I ended up with a bit of a compromise. Rather than kind of just a catalog of what everybody is doing in this area, I would briefly review a bit about the history of pediatric and perinatal epidemiology at McGill and at the Children's Hospital, a very brief current catalog of the cast of characters of the faculty and their research areas. And I'm going to discuss three methodologic contributions, because I think this is a department that has an emphasis on methods, and I'm going to talk about three of the areas that have methodologic components, at least, that I've been involved in and that many of the people in this room have also been involved in. And then finally, just a little bit on impacts that people in this area have had over the years. So here's the brief history. It started with Barry Pless, who is not here today, but I understand will be here this evening. He came to McGill in 1975. His primary interest was chronic disease in children and adaptation among children with chronic disease. But he quickly changed after being here for a few years and for the rest of his career really focused in the area of child injury. He was born joined by Charles Larson in 1976, who shared some of interest in chronic disease in children. Charles was very interested in childhood disability, but he went on to really be more interested in global child health. And I came in 1978. And then we had a number of pediatricians, most of whom trained in this department, who joined the departments of pediatrics and this department in the 1980s. Mike Moffitt, Jeff Doherty, Francis Duchamp, Kieran Duffy, who trained elsewhere but came to the Children's as well in those years. We were blessed with having two biostatisticians, not at the same time, unfortunately, but Antonio Ciampi, who came in 1985, and then Rob Platt, who you'll meet later, came in 1996. Since 2000 or so, there have been many pediatrician epidemiologists recruited at the MCH, some of whom have formal appointments or adjunct appointments in this department, many of whom were trained here do not. And unlike the initial group, who are all general pediatricians, most of the pediatrician epidemiologists nowadays are subspecialists, and you'll see their names in a moment. And then in the last few years, there have been a big input in terms of perinatal epidemiology with the arrival of Jay Kaufman, Olga Basso, Ashley Naini, and Sung Mi Yang most recently. This is just a list of the current faculty that I put in perinatal epi. I've mentioned all these names before, so I'll just skip this quickly. There are a lot here that many people in this room won't know, and these are the people in pediatric epi. As I said, most of them, all of them are in the Department of Pediatrics, have appointments, and some of them have adjunct appointments here, but they've all had formal training in epidemiology and biostatistics. So the first two, Beth Foster and Mike Zapatelli, are both pediatric nephrologists, one focusing on chronic kidney disease, the other on acute renal injury or kidney injury. Caroline Quach, you've just met. In addition to her in infectious diseases, Jesse Papenberg has recently joined the Department of Pediatrics. And he's a degree recipient from here. The two general pediatricians on this group are mentioned next, Evelyn Constantine, who does work on sleep disorders in children, Patricia Lee, who's a health services researcher who studies primary access and quality of primary care to children. On the next column, Miranda Nakla, who's a pediatric endocrinologist, diabetologist, whose particular interest is in health service use by children with type 1 diabetes. Miriam Osqui, a pediatric neurologist whose particular interest is in the epidemiology and health service use of children with cerebral palsy. Patricia Fontella, who's an intensivist, pediatric intensivist, interested in nosocomial infections in the ICU. Moshe Ben-Shoshan, who's a pediatric immunologist allergist who does work on the causes and prevention of food allergy in children. And me and Rob Platt, who's, as you say, are kind of in both camps and doing work in both the perinatal and pediatric areas. So I'm going to start on those three methodologic contributions, and this department has had an important input into this paradox of the intersecting perinatal mortality curves. In fact, it's such an important phenomenon, or certainly written about phenomenon, that it recently was the subject of a whole series of articles in the International Journal of Epidemiology. It was first described by Yerushalmi, whose name many of you will know, and it had to do with the outcomes of pregnancy in smokers and non-smokers, first published in 1964. It was well known even before Yerushalmi that smokers had women who smoked during pregnancy had a higher risk of low birth weight. But what Yerushalmi pointed out was that in those low birth weight mothers who were born to smokers, those babies born to smokers had a lower neonatal mortality than those born also at low birth weight to non-smokers. So it seemed to seemed to protect the low birth weight babies. Well, that was a bit of a shock when it first appeared. And of course, the reverse is true for babies above 2,500 grams. These papers, there were a series of them, were used by the tobacco companies for decades to point out why cigarette smoking during pregnancy was not dangerous to the fetus and to the newborn infant. In fact, this phenomenon with smoking has been found now for virtually all risk factors for preterm birth or low birth weight, and it's been found whether you divide it by birth weight or whether you divide it by gestational age. So one of the people that's been interested in this area is an illustrious alumnus of this department, K.S. Joseph, who's now at the University of British Columbia. And this shows a similar phenomenon. This is the crossover paradox, and what's shown here is the perinatal mortality that's combined stillbirth and early neonatal mortality. I'm comparing whites and blacks. We know blacks in U.S. for 1997. We know blacks have a higher perinatal mortality overall, but if you graph it as a function of gestational age at each gestational age, you can see this is per 1,000 total births. At the lowest gestational ages, the blacks actually have a lower perinatal mortality than the whites. And then they kind of hang together here at around 34, 35 weeks. And starting at around 36 weeks, the reverse happens. So this is the crossover that you see here. Now, the question is, what's the appropriate denominator? That's per 1,000 total births at each gestational age. Now, it's been long known that you can use total stillbirths, regardless of gestational age or birth weight, and as an appropriate denominator for calculating the risk of stillbirth. But for gestational age-specific stillbirth risk, the total births at that gestational age is inappropriate. It conditions on birth at that gestational age, which at early gestational ages is already abnormal. And in fact, that risk expressed that way is just the proportion of births born dead at that gestational age. It's not the risk of stillbirth at that gestational age. And the reason for that is all the fetuses that you don't see that are not born are at risk for being stillborn at that gestational age. And by conditioning on births, you've kind of you've restricted the denominator to those who are actually born, which is a kind of a crazy thing to do in epidemiology. So this argument for stillbirths was made as long ago as it's made more than a quarter of a century ago by Yudkin and her colleagues in the UK. And this just illustrates the phenomenon of this inappropriate denominator. These are 10 pregnancies, 9 of which end up in a live birth, and this one in a stillbirth. And if we were to consider the gestational age specific stillbirth rate at 29 weeks here, 29 completed weeks, in other words, between 29 and 30 weeks, if you count it as a fraction of all births in that 30th week, or between 29 and 30 weeks, it's 500 per 1,000 total births, one out of two. On the other hand, if you count it for all fetuses who are still in utero at this gestational age, which is all 10, it's 100 per 1,000 fetuses at risk. In other words, one out of 10. So it's a big difference between those two. And as I said, this was pointed out a long time ago for stillbirth. And as you can see, if you use that denominator, that is per 1,000 fetuses at risk instead of 1,000 total births, there's no crossover. This is the same year data, same race comparison of whites and blacks at every gestational age when the fetuses are used as a denominator. The whites have a lower stillbirth rate than do the blacks, or the blacks have a higher one at every gestational age. But then the question is, what about neonatal mortality? That's the other half of the perinatal mortality. K.S. Joseph, back in the early 2000s, pointed out that fetuses at any given gestational age are at risk of live birth within the next week. And therefore, since all live births are at risk for neonatal death, particularly at early gestational ages, all fetuses are at risk for neonatal death within the next week, because they can be born live and die within the next week. So what happens when you use fetuses at risk to look at neonatal mortality? Well, you see the same thing. There's an uncrossing of the curves. At every gestational age, when expressed as per 1,000 fetuses at risk, the blacks have a higher risk of neonatal death than do the whites. And this work, which I mentioned, K.S. Joseph, I've been involved in it. Robert Platt's been involved with it. Our statistical colleague at the Children's, Sun Shang, has been involved in this. And so many members of the department have been involved in this work. The next area I'm going to talk about is preterm birth, also a major area of activity for the perinatal epidemiologists in the department. This is a graph that shows the rate of preterm birth from 1981 to 2010. And like many other developed countries, high-income countries, there was a huge increase, a substantial increase, anyway, between about 6 and 8% over the 80s and 90s until the mid-2000s. And then it peaked in Canada at 2004, and it's come down a bit since then. Just by way of comparison here, the comparable data over a roughly comparable period of a little over 30 years in the U.S., showing the rates in whites, showing a very similar pattern, although theirs peaked in 2006 and has come down since 2006. Blacks did not go up during the 80s and 90s, but since 2006 have also come down, but they have much higher rates of preterm birth. That's a subject of another talk another time. But also another important thing to point out here is that the rate of preterm birth, even among U.S. whites in the early 80s, was about as high as it ever got in the mid-2000s in Canada. But the same upturn and the recent downturn were seen in the U.S. as in Canada. What's the reason for this? Why did preterm birth go up, and why has it come down? This slide illustrates what I think is a truth, and that is that preterm birth is a socially contagious disease. This is a map of the U.S. you'll recognize, and you can see that based on the color, the darker the color, the higher the rate. There's a tendency for states that are contiguous with one another to have similar rates, similarly high or similarly low, depending on where they're located and who their neighbors are. Now, in the Deep South, you could say, well, that's because of the black versus white phenomenon. Then we know that blacks have much higher rates of preterm birth than the whites do. But Florida doesn't have a lot of blacks, and neither does Oklahoma, and even Texas doesn't have very many blacks. And Nevada and Arizona have very few blacks, so that's not sufficient explanation to explain those high rates. And you have other states in the Midwest, for example, in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Illinois, that have very high black populations and yet don't have as high a preterm birth rate. So there's something about local practice, let's say, that you do like your neighbors do, and you don't stray out of line too much with other people in your city or your state, or your region at least. And we carried out it's impossible to study the effect of obstetric intervention individually using observational data because things like induction, which we know can end pregnancy very, very rapidly, are done for a reason most of the time. They're not done particularly at preterm gestational ages. So we looked at it. We did this ecological analysis where each of these points here is a state compared for two time periods, the early 2000s versus 10 years earlier. Each one of these is a state. This one down here is the District of Columbia. And it shows the change in the preterm birth rate over that 10-year period as a function of the change in induction rate. Now, most of the states had an increase between 5 and 15% in induction rates and an increase of between 1 and 3 percent in the preterm birth rate over this time period. And you see a very strong correlation. Those states that had the largest increase in induction had the largest increase in preterm birth. Finally, the last area I'm going to talk about is breastfeeding. So I want to move out of the perinatal area into the pediatric area. And this is another area that has methodologic challenges. A lot of the health benefits of breastfeeding, particularly the ones like neurocognitive development, growth, and obesity, are really, really hard to study in observational studies, because sometimes we put the cart before the horse and we get reverse causality, particularly with growth and obesity affecting breastfeeding. And sometimes the kind of potent factors of maternal interaction with the infant and lifestyle issues that are very hard to measure can be very potent confounders. Now, it would be nice if we could do an RCT, a randomized controlled trial, but we know that randomization to breastfeeding or artificial feeding works in animals but not in humans. So we've carried out an RCT of an intervention to promote breastfeeding exclusivity. This is a breastfeeding promotion program, taking women who are already initiating breastfeeding and trying to get them to breastfeed longer and more exclusively. And we had to use a very, very large sample size to do this. Stan Shapiro was very instrumental in the design of this trial. And it's called PROBIT, the Promotion of Breastfeeding Intervention Trial. It's cluster randomized. The units randomized were hot maternity hospitals and affiliated clinics. Because the time is running short, we had to use a very large sample size because of the overlap in behaviors. These are not mice, so the ones who were exposed to the intervention would not necessarily do what we were suggesting or supporting them to do, and the ones that were not exposed might do prolonged and exclusive breastfeeding. So we needed we had 31 maternity hospitals and affiliated clinics, 17,000 mothers and healthy babies. And those sample size in terms of the number of clusters and the number of individuals was based on the primary outcome, which was reducing the risk of a gastrointestinal infection in the first year, which we did succeed in doing. And the births actually occurred between 1996 and 1997. This is the baby-friendly hospital initiative. I won't go over these features in detail, but it's a pretty big deal to change maternity hospitals to do these things, and it took between 6 and 15 months after we started this intervention for the hospitals and clinics to be ready to start enrolling babies. Here's the graph that shows the difference in the control in red and the experimental. Any breastfeeding, initiated breastfeeding, and you can see there was separation that was maintained throughout the first year. Big differences in the degree of breastfeeding, whether defined as predominant breastfeeding at 3 or 6 months or exclusive breastfeeding at 3 and 6 months. Much higher, 7 times the exclusive breastfeeding rate at 3 months in the experimental group compared to the control group. So we have two cohorts now that differed substantially in the exclusivity and duration of breastfeeding. Those differences, not in the individual mother and doctor decided how long he and how exclusively that baby would be breastfed, but the difference between the groups was created by randomization. And that's enabled a very strong causal inferences that get around these problems of reverse causality and confounding that I mentioned that has plagued this field. And we've been, because it's a large randomized trial with good follow-up rates, we've been able to get funding to do follow-ups for various outcomes at 6.5, 11.5, and most recently 16 years, where the data are still being collected but are almost finished. So I'll just finish by this last slide talking about a few of the impacts that some of this research from the perinatal and pediatric epidemiology group have had over the years. Barry Pless was one of the movers and shakers behind the Children's Hospital Injury Reporting and Prevention Program, which is a surveillance program for childhood injury and based in children's hospital emergency departments, and it started in 1990. K.S. Joseph and I were instrumental in starting the Canadian perinatal surveillance system about 5 years later, which does perinatal surveillance on infant mortality, maternal mortality, morbidity, stillbirth, preterm birth and the rest of it. Some of the work I showed you from our breastfeeding trial had an influence on the World Health Assembly's decision in 2001 to change their recommendation about the optimal duration of exclusive breastfeeding from 4 to 6 to 6 months. And you saw that reduction in preterm births since the mid-2000s. I wouldn't claim that our studies about induction are solely responsible for that, because many other people have been working in this area. But the best evidence is that this downturn that you see since 2006 in the U.S. and 2004 in Canada is a little bit more caution and less of that social contagion about doing inductions or pre-labor cesareans. So I'll stop there. And thank you very much for your attention.